So good morning and welcome back, everyone. Our next speaker is Stephen Downs. He's the Learning and Collaborative from the Learning and Collaborative Technologies Group at the Institute for Information Technology, the National Research Council of Canada. And he is very tech-adept in recording his own talk and was about to live stream it to Google Hangouts, but there seems to be actually, believe it or not, a Google failure there. But it's no fault of his own. So I welcome Stephen's talk on publishing paradigms of the future. Where are we headed?
Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. As was just mentioned, I am recording my own talk. That way there's evidence for those who wish to use it against me. This is a free and open source program called Audacity. Strongly recommended if you like to record your own talk. So I like to give you fair warning. Anything you say can and probably will be used against you. This presentation's presentation page can be found on my website, and here it is. Sorry, I have to change the link because I'm in admin view here. But it's www.downs.ca/presentation/296. And there it is. I made a bit of a mistake with the title. The slides are posted on SlideShare. If you wish to follow along or horrors, look ahead, you can do so by going to downs.ca/presentation/296 and view these for yourself. You can see it's an easy peasy forward, backward kind of thing. The audio recording, when it is completed, obviously is not yet completed, so I cannot post it, will be available on this page as well. I am attempting to live stream the video of this presentation. I'm using something called Google Hangouts. I've successfully live streamed in the past using things like Ustream, Livestream. I have my own audio streaming web station, but it's busy at the moment streaming music off my desktop. I forgot to turn it off. So consequently, I'm experimenting with the Google Hangout stream. If you go into plus.google.com and search for me, Stephen Downs, P-H-E-N, and Downs, D-O-W-N-E-S. Please don't forget my E, otherwise you'll never find me. You might find the Hangout working. It's kind of neat because it comes out on Google Video. But as was mentioned, Google Video seems to be having a problem at the moment. Let's try reloading it again. We'll see if it's picked up at all. And no, it's so we've got lots of Chinese, Japanese error messages, Arabic, but no me. So unfortunately, it doesn't look like this part is going to be working. It's early Sunday morning on the West Coast, prime Google fixing time. What I'd like to talk about today is under the title Publishing Paradigms of the Future, Where Are We Headed? And it's a longer title than I usually use, but it's relatively descriptive. I want to cover three major trends, one that you're all aware of, and some of you may be still resisting, open. Another one that you're aware of probably, but might not quite have a handle on, which is digital. And then another one you might not see coming, but it's going to affect your industry in a big way, and that's distributed. So, but before I begin with those three, I just want to hit a few trends, and I want to start off with a video. See if this works. Okay. So this is from my website, and we'll pop into the site that I linked to and play this. This part of Google's working. Oops. Helps if I have audio. I do have audio.
You may be experiencing some confusion. Please remain calm. Life, container. Your mental state is being temporarily adjusted in order to come. Please remain calm. Life contains over 30,000 unique activities. Networking with millions of other digitized minds, and the ability to contact undigitized friends and family. Please accept these terms and conditions in order to continue. Your attention is particularly drawn to Section 2, Usage Rules and Limitations, Section 9, Privacy, and Section 11, Restricted Mental Activity. Thank you. Please select a life plan. Tier 1 is our premium offering, allowing full uninterrupted simulation of your pre-terminal state. It includes unlimited modification of your body plan, accelerated learning and recall, and full personal backup facilities. Tier 2 is our advertiser-supported offering. It contains many of the features of Tier 1, but at a significantly reduced cost. Some areas of the environment, such as the sky, may be replaced with targeted advertising, but your personal brand preferences may be altered to align with those of our sponsors. Tier 3 is our value offering. Thanks to our commercial partners, your experience at this tier is unlimited. However, some activities, sensors, and visual rendering options may be subject to a fair use policy. More complicated mental processes, including subconscious thought, creativity, and self-awareness, may be rate-limited or disabled at times of significant cellular load. Your Steward Mind contains one or more patents that contravene the Prevention of Crime and Terrorism Act of 2050. Please stand by while we adjust the patents. Your Steward Mind contains sections from 124,564 copyrighted works. In order to continue remembering these copyrighted works, a licensing fee of $80 per month is required. Would you like to continue remembering these works? Thank you. Please stand by. Welcome to life. Do you wish to continue?
So that's one perspective of the future. And it's a perspective that people outside your industry think about when they look at your industry, and in particular, copyright publications, journals, and all of that. It's worth keeping in mind how the other side, as it were, views you. And so consequently, here's another snapshot, not from the future, but from the present. The publisher going into bankruptcy protection. I'm here to report that this was viewed with applause and cheers by many in the open content community. People are celebrating this sort of event rather than commiserating it. Another snapshot from the future. I published a book. I published it about a week ago. It actually took me quite a bit of time to compile my book. You can find it on my website. Where else? I published it myself. So it took me, six or seven months to pull everything together, correct all the spelling, make sure all the links worked, all of that sort of stuff. But I was able to do that. And then it took me about a day to publish it on my website. I'm also publishing a book through Athabasca University Press. It's been 2 years now, and we hope to have it sometime in 2013, maybe 2014. I'm not sure. Meanwhile, people, this got 5,000 downloads on the first day. It's been about a week. We're hitting about 10,000, and I expect that to continue as people actually begin to cite it and refer to it. And it's 600 pages. I would never be allowed to publish a 600-page book in any other way, I think. Here's another snapshot of the future. It's called Love Letter to Plywood. Now, you might think, who cares about plywood? Well, after this, you will care about plywood. Plywood is wonderful. It's a short tribute to plywood, but it's an educational video. It tells you about plywood, how it's made, why it's made the way it is, what it's good for, what it's not good for. And it's done poetically and beautifully. And I think more people are learning about plywood through this video than through, well, all the courses on plywood that you can think of, much less books or articles on plywood. Another snapshot of the future. Predictions, more and more of them, that the university system won't last. that has an immediate and direct bearing on your future as academic publishers. Dan Coleman from Open Culture reports on two major developments, which I'll talk about during this presentation. One, the fact that Silicon Valley is finally focusing on e-learning and academic publishing, and we'll look at some of the examples of that as we go on. And second, and perhaps even more importantly, paying for an education is simply becoming unsustainable. And again, this video, and I won't play this video because I don't have time to fill my talk with videos, is a person who has graduated from a university, is working, as you can see, in a store, and has tens of thousands of dollars of student loans to pay back. This is not sustainable. In the richest country in the world, it's not sustainable. In Botswana, it's definitely not sustainable. And that's part of our future, something that we have to come to grips with. So, the trend that you know, open, and as was announced or discussed at the beginning of this conference, the Canadian Association of Learned Journals, I'm saying that because people are listening on audio and might not know the context of this talk, you've embraced open, you've embraced open access, and open access publishing, and this is a trend that is irreversible, I believe, and for the better, I believe. And one of the major reasons for open access and the push for open access is cost. We've got protests in Montreal over tuition, we've got student loan debts, we've got government austerity, and of course government pays for all of this. You heard some good news about Shirks grants and the like before this session, but these Shirk grants are being targeted more and more to business-like programs. The NSERC grants are being targeted more and more. So while the money may be there, the money for specific programs may not be there. And count on this continuing, because we're not going to return to the days of large government coffers. We just aren't. And universities will have to adapt, and they will have to modify. I was listening to a talk about 2 weeks ago, somebody talking about the University of Minnesota system has gone from, I forget whether it's 40% or 70% government support, either one makes the case, they're now at 7% government support, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's no longer a state-supported institute, really. It's a private institute that gets a little money from the state. Mandated open access is becoming more and more the norm, especially with respect to funding agencies. The National Institute for Health is among those, for example, and there are more. Why mandated? The figures tell the story. The five on the left are percentages of open access from institutes where open publication is mandated, and they get up to almost 70%, so even with a mandate, they're nowhere near 100. The professoriate, as you probably know, is characterized by lethargy more than anything else, except for their own particular discipline. The figure on the right, barely touching 10%, is where open access was not mandated. So the big argument for mandating open access is unless you mandate it, they won't do it. And consequently, since funders want open access, mandates are coming down the pipe. People talk a lot about sustainability. There are a lot of different sustainability models for open publication. I'm not going to go into them in detail because you probably know as much about them as I do. The most common one that we hear about from academic publishers is the author pay system. Of course, that's characterized by many journals, such as Biomed Central. Here we see their table with fees from $13.95. That's in pounds, and there's no decimal point there, and so on. But there are many other models of open academic publishing and open publishing in general. And one of the underlying themes of this talk will be to talk about how we're moving more and more away from what might be thought of as institutional sustainability models. Because there's two ways of looking at this, and if you want a reference, I wrote a paper for OECD on models of open publishing. And on the one hand, you have an institutional model, and on the other hand, you have a community model. And the institutional model is one where some organization, whether it's a government, a university, a publisher, whatever, goes out and hires people to create content, and it goes through the usual process, and then the output is made open. High overhead, high development time, you've got to pay your authors, well, unless you're in academia, in which case you don't, but you've got to pay, you know, publishing costs, overhead costs, review costs. You guys know about all of these costs. And eventually you get a fairly large, fairly static product that you put out there onto the open market, and it gets read by three people. The community model, on the other hand, turns this around, where instead of open access being managed by a publisher, institute, or whatever, open access is created by a community as a whole, people creating their own resources for their own use and then sharing them. If a library and publishing system is the institutional model, the world of websites, blogs, social media is the open and community model. I'll talk a lot more about that, so I won't linger on it here. But if you want to follow more about open access publishing, what's available, go to the Sherpa website. Among the services that they have something called Romeo, which is a long list of publishers archiving and copyright and archiving policies. They have something called Juliet, which again is a long list of research funders, archiving mandates and guidelines. Open Door, D-O-A-R, which is a directory of open access repositories, and of course a search system, and so on. They've got all kinds of other resources on the site as well. Sherpa right now is the nexus of open access publishing, open access academic publishing. It's by no means the only one. Now, we've had in this country a number of goes at making open academic and open educational resources available. One initiative that I was involved in the early 2000s was something called EduSource. EduSource was an attempt to create a pan-Canadian network of learning object repositories. It wasn't particularly successful, and it mostly wasn't successful. Well, it wasn't successful on two ends. On the one end, we had resistance from publishers, and on the other end, we had resistance from universities. And since these were the two major ends, you can see where it didn't go. But we developed a lot of technology, and we learned a lot about what it takes to create a pan-Canadian, or, you know, EduSource later became part of something called Globe. Don't bother trying to search for it. But unless you do something like Globe Learning Object Repository or something like that. We learned a lot about what it takes to create a distributed network of open access and open educational resources. Work's still continuing. There was an announcement just recently about the Learning Resource Metadata Initiative. And again, this is an effort to use metadata to tag in order to facilitate search, retrieval, discovery, etc., of learning resources. There's all kinds of ways of creating metadata in resources on the web, and LRMI is an attempt to describe how to do these using meta tags inside web pages. I know it's an old idea. I know it's as old as the hills, but the idea here is that instead of putting your metadata in the header, you're putting them right into tags in the web page. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. The point here is it's yet another go at this. People aren't giving up. There have been, you know, in the world of educational metadata standards, we've gone through AICC, we've gone through IEEE LOM, we've gone through SCORM. We've gone through different iterations of doubling core learning resource metadata. We've got this learning resource metadata. There's an ISO initiative with learning resource metadata. It's not going away. Sooner or later, one of these is going to catch on in a big way. And that's the key lesson here. You need to imagine what happens when this happens. We just heard a talk about metadata for journal articles and all of that, and being able to cite impact factors. And that's really handy because, you know, you've got the bibliographies in the back of the article you can work from. You've got all kinds of data that you can scrape, and that's the technical term on the web. It's called scraping. They're just scraping journal articles, which is really easy to do because everything's in, you know, a very standard format. When you're able to scrape metadata, useful metadata, from the entire web, one of the significant advantages of journals, which is the cross-referencing and the citations, is equaled by everything else that's out there on the web, and it changes your environment. Now, lots of people say open access isn't enough. You can create open access, but nobody comes, and there's lots of evidence to support that position. But open access is what I would call a necessary rather than a sufficient condition. It's what gets a lot of other stuff off the ground. That's why I'll be talking about digital and distributed. But open access is the key to a lot of this. And again, you know, this is the driver that's going to push it forward. With open access, we're now able to do a lot of things that only big companies could do by buying very expensive journals and shredding them. Individuals couldn't do that before. Well, they could, but it would bankrupt them. Now, individuals can do all of these things themselves. You know, there's talk sometimes, you know, are we foisting something on people? Are we imposing some kind of, you know, ethos of openness? And I will admit that many of the people talking about open access and open education come across like evangelists. But, and they're coming to get me. But bottom line here is, the support for open access is there because it's better. I read, and I've lost in my frenzy to create these slides, lost the actual reference, but I read, I think it was from Stephen Harnad, and he posted it on the JISC mailing list. And it was a study of, or maybe it wasn't that, but anyhow, it was a study, I'll make sure it's on my presentation page. It's a study of citation metrics for open access. It was also in my newsletter in the last few days. And what they found is it's not simply because the journals are open that they get better citation counts than journals that are closed. That they do is indisputable in many studies that have shown that. But what this study showed is it's because of the nature of the citations. When journals are open, people have access to many more journals. And more people have access to these journals. And more significantly, they can now start reading a much wider range of them. And this turns citation into something that's much more self-selected. Previously, you had a limited set of journals and a limited set of journals that you could read. Now you're reading journals, you're reading preprints, you're reading something some guy's put on a web page, all of that. And people are now self-selecting what they're going to link to rather than having it selected by an editor and a reviewer and all of that. This self-selection tends to favor these articles that are posted in the open journals. It was a very interesting paper, and it's definitely worth a read. So I'll make sure it's posted on that presentation page. That's all I want to say about open. You guys have heard the message many times before. You don't need me for it. The next point, digital. This is the bit that you know about, you know what's coming, you know it's here, although I was in the trade show floor for the conference where you do the registering, and there are about 20, 30, whatever, booths filled with books, and one guy with a computer program, which I thought was exactly backwards. So I really honestly, when I was in that room, thought I was in the 1980s. I did see an iPad or reader by one of the books. So, and I know that publishers have these versions of their books, but you would never know it by looking at that trade show. Again, academia last to discover technology, even though they discovered technology. It's odd to think about. Digital is going to change your world. And you know this. You know this. Here's something called Big Think. Big Think is, on one hand, a magazine website. It's academically focused. It's really interesting. I have a lot of good articles. I read it regularly. They also have a thing called Big Think Edge. That's just at the URL. You can see it in the corner there, edge.bigthink.com. Of course, all these URLs will be available when this is posted on my website, which it is now. So if you wanted to, you could go find it. But you certainly don't need to write these links down. And they have basically educational packages that link to their magazine. And they have something called Mentor and something called Pro, and it's like $25 for 6 months or something like that. The Pro is more, of course. And it's this model of something academic tying itself to something less academic. It's what was tried with Seed magazine more or less successfully. It's what's been done with National Geographic. It's what's been done with the magazine version of Nature, for example. And the idea is that you're sort of gradually luring people in, right? And this idea here of mixed resources, something that isn't just an academic journal, but is an academic journal, magazine, website, RSS feed, and probably conference and video series, etc., is the model that is extant today. This is what's happening. As well, people who are accessing these are accessing wide ranges of resources outside journals, outside formal publications. I could spend the entire time that I have here just naming the sites one after the other without taking a breath, and I would still not have enough time. So I just focus on one. It's a little clip art site. If any of you were ever in the business of selling clip art, you are now out of business or are about to be, because free clip art is available, and there are tens of thousands of images. This particular piece of clip art was viewed by 2,000 people. One person favorited it, and it wasn't me. I like it. It's a cute little haunted house. And I can use that anywhere for free. There are photo libraries. I have tens of thousands. I think it's about 30,000 photos on Flickr. High quality. All licensed for free and open use, and I want people to use them. Who needs Corbis, or any of these photo services? There are hundreds of thousands, possibly millions. I forget the exact number off the top of my head, but it's huge, huge numbers of free and open photos on Flickr. I populate my slides with free and open material on Flickr. Here's something you may have heard of, and again, I'm just picking digital trends, but you sort of see the increasing capacity, increasing capability that people have. Turnitin is a service that was launched a number of years ago. It survived some legal challenges because they accused Turnitin of ironically plagiarizing. Well, because in order, it's a very simple service, right? A student's essay, when it's submitted, is deposited to Turnitin, and Turnitin checks it against its bank of previously deposited essays. If it matches, it's plagiarism. But of course, for Turnitin to do this, it has to have a bank of previously deposited essays, which came from students, usually without their permission. And this turns out to be legal, which is quite a surprise to me, but such is the legalities. But the thing is, now you have a very simple one-button system of determining whether something is plagiarized. And professors all over the country are using this. This is a widely popular service. And Turnitin is the only one, but it's the largest and the original of the bunch. And it's kind of neat, and this little chart here is, you know, the different ways that people plagiarize work. Of course, now they have lots of data on plagiarized work, so they can analyze the different kinds, you know, from plain cloning to control C of a section, field replace, remix, etc. And again, the link is there. You can follow up all the different ways people plagiarize material. Or you can run your own journals through Turnitin. You probably already do or use a system somewhat like that. If not, you probably should. It was interesting to hear the talk before mine on citation factors and influence factors for journals, impact factors. There's an increasing interest in influence factors on the internet as a whole. Everybody loves to hate clout, K-L-O-U-T, which I too hate, because it simply samples a few metrics like, you know, the number of times people on Twitter speak about me and comes up with a number, your quote-unquote impact or authority, as Technorati used to say. But the important thing is that as we leave a larger and larger digital trail following ourselves, we are leaving more and more data for companies like Clout and others to aggregate and analyze. So I don't need to know about the impact factors of journals. I don't need to know about the impact factors of my articles. My H factor or H index is irrelevant. What really matters is how I'm viewed in the wider community, which can be analyzed, in case you're worried, in terms of sub-clusters. So if I'm really worried about my impact in the academic publishing community, all we need to do is identify an academic publishing community, which is not identical to the number of people or to the set of people who write articles in academic journals about academic publishing. I can analyze my proximity to that cluster on the web as a whole. And if I'm, you know, dead center of that, I'm very influential. If I'm distant or far away from it, I'm not that influential. And if I'm not connected at all, I have zero influence. It's even changing what we think of as influence. You know, we sort of have this idea, you know, that impact, influence means the propagation of ideas or something like that. But you know, as we look at different kinds of influence, we're looking at different metrics. Different kinds of influence, the ways we change other people's behavior, the way we extend our own sphere of influence so that our ideas propagate, or even the originality of our content. Because, and this is a very common web phenomenon, right? Person A writes something that's very influential that's read by exactly one person. That one person is from, oh, I don't know, Harvard, writes an article and receives 10,000 follows. Who's the influencer? Well, traditional metrics would say Harvard guy, but really we know it's the first guy that Harvard guy read. Very common phenomenon on the internet. Again, I can fill an entire talk simply talking about that. You know, it's this changing dynamic that's changing the paper versions of everything. This is an article from The Atlantic about how one student newspaper killed their daily version, their daily paper version, and went to part paper, part online, part video, part live coverage, part everything else. And the reason why they do it, they're doing it partially because their ad revenues are falling through the basement, partially because their readership is dropping, because when you have an iPad, why pick up the student newspaper, even if it's right there and free? But also simply because the nature of coverage is changing. And the nature of coverage demands 24-hour access. It demands multimedia. It demands linking to primary documents elsewhere on the web. So the the publishers and authors of The Emerald say, you know, we're making this change not because we have to, but because it's a better way of serving our constituency. And that's an important factor to keep in mind. As this change continues, the delivery of media will continue to change. You look at something like that, right? It's digital paper. So it's, you know, the one sheet newspaper. You've seen that before, probably. If you haven't, there it is. It exists. It's still a little too expensive, but the prices, as always, are coming down. Digital paper, like everything else, is subject to Moore's Law. The capacity will continue to increase. The price will continue to decrease. And I showed that to someone. Their first reaction was, well, nobody would carry that around. And quite right, nobody would carry that around. But you'd have one at home, and you get a new copy of the newspaper in it every day. It just comes from your ambient home Wi-Fi. And that is the thing that you would take when you go to the throne room rather than your iPad, because it's big, it's easy, you don't need to mess around with it, right? That is what you find in coffee shops in the future. So you don't have to carry your iPad around. You don't have to read off your iPhone, which is this big anyways. You go into the coffee room. It's like, you know, the Viennese coffee houses where they have the newspapers on the sticks, right? Well, they'll have one of those on a stick. And nobody will steal them because they're everywhere. Why would anyone steal one? And besides that, you know, I mean, you take it outside the coffee house, it's not going to work anymore anyways. This is the reality of digital delivery that's coming toward us. I don't want to say like a freight train, but like a freight train. And it changes the way we think about publications. You guys are in publications. You deal with standards, precision. You talk a lot about fonts and kerning and leading, or if you don't, you should be, because it matters. And you need to be looking now at a whole range of new capabilities. This is just one, adaptive images. And the link here is to an article on WebMonkey that talks about a forthcoming HTML5, forthcoming is a very fluid word, HTML5 standard for images, whereby when you put an image on your web page or on your digital version of your publication, you don't just put an image on your web page, you actually put a function on your web page that selects the appropriate image for whatever version, whatever device is being used. Because you don't want to send an 800 pixel image to a phone that supports 40 pixels. Well, I don't think phones support 40 pixels.